as we started growing, I could feel that people were not connected to one another. This was the time where Great Resignation and then those things were at the top of the Google searches. You know, I think TikTok had a video of employees attaching their mouse to a fan and the mouse was moving. They were just doing their own thing, but they were not really focused, not really feeling like working. So I removed an entire hierarchical process of appraisals. My idea was, how do I make people and employees feel like they belong and they matter? So this was the vision. That wasn't my vision. But I was in the same room when that was discussed. And that's when we came up with a peer-to-peer review, completely eradicating an appraisal system from top down, but just giving the opportunity for peers to talk about their peers. And that's where we developed that system, which worked really well for us.
Hello and welcome to the Gross Profit Podcast. My name is James Kennedy. I'm the CEO and co-founder at ProcurementExpress.com. We take the hassle out of managing your company's purchasing with magical features, but we're not here to talk about that today. What happens when a CFO goes rogue and creativity takes the lead in finance? Well, today we're going to discuss this with Hayat Emin, someone who prides himself on introducing a not traditionally creative field, infusing it with some traditional non-conformist thinking. And we're going to pick through some of his career highlights, demonstrating how this has helped him to get ahead. Hayat is someone who works with high growth startup and high end tech companies, including those mentored through the Techstars program. This should be a wild ride, and we'll learn about some interesting KPIs I'm very certain that no one has ever come across before. Okay. So Hayat, thank you very much for coming to the show. Maybe you could just tell us a bit about yourself. Where are you? And give us an idea of your background.
My name is Hayat Emin. I have been in the sort of tech scene for the last 15 years, predominantly in the UK and US. I live in the UK. I live in London, in Crystal Palace, if anybody wants to know. The way I would like to summarize my career, I think I would say someone who is responsible for dressing up the company before they go on a date. And that could be from the way they look. And I'm a big believer that you have to be absolutely tight inside to be able to look good on the outside. So, and inside, outside, the person who brushes up the hair, the person who fixes the accounts, the person who is responsible for how the company comes across. That has been my role for the last 15 years or so.
So, I mean, in the tech sector in particular, it's all about raising growth. The perception is as important as their reality sometimes, and being able to put the best foot forward is what it's all about. When I'm investing in a tech stock, it's typically a growth stock. So I'm looking for the enterprise value to rise as much as possible. And that's basically based on how big that company is going to be in a year, 5 years, 10 years. And yet at the same time, tech founders aren't always well known for being the best groomed people in the room. Speaking as well myself, I can get that. So what are the go-tos when you start working with a fast-growing tech company? What are the things you find you need to focus on to help them shine that they wouldn't necessarily be doing without you?
It has to start from the inside. So typically what I would do, I would go into a company, I would be a fly on the wall, understand how the business operates, understand the mission and the overall ethos of the company. The biggest value add, what I typically add, is if there is a CEO with a grand vision, a traditional CFO would come in and they would say, you're dreaming, it doesn't work. Have you seen the cost? Have you seen unit economics? Have you seen the current market? But what I tend to do is come in and work with this visionary founder and quantify that vision. I quantify that vision where I put steps in place that makes it more realistic for the team, the investor, or the stakeholder to really believe this is possible. So if someone could come to you and say, my mission is to go to Mars, my job is to quantify exactly what it would take from using OKRs, financial models, operational frameworks that I've learned over the last 15 years and make it a reality by quantifying that process.
So many of the companies you're working with are not super early. They're at the later stage. At that stage, the growing pains start to kick in. Like, it's all very well being a startup when it's young and it's five people and a team and there's not much to do other than just try and get shit done, pardon my French. And then as these companies, which get massive amounts of financial injection and things grow, it's all about adding more people. Suddenly you can end up in a place where the culture can atrophy. Have you experienced that? And if it hasn't been fixed from the start, how do you reverse engineer a better work environment for something that wasn't designed to be huge oftentimes? Oftentimes these are, no one thought about hundreds of people working there when they started.
Yeah.
So yeah, maybe tell us a bit about your experience in that later stage of startup growth when it comes to affecting the culture and aligning with that CEO's vision.
So working as a consultant, being part of so many companies, hundreds and hundreds of them, I do see quite a massive trend that as they grow, culture becomes a piece of paper where there's seven values that people need to stick to.
Right.
And yes, at the start, it does come from the heart. It does come from the sort of the gut of the founders and the early employees believe it, but it is very clear that that goes away quite quickly. I study the greats. I study companies like Stripe. I study companies like ServiceNow. There's massive companies that have kept that essence of working and really feeling like you have an impact within the company.
Let me ask you about that. I mean, Stripe is a fascinating company to me. They seem to have a very different way of working to a lot of companies. I know they focus a lot on the written word. The way they run their meetings seem to be different. The founders, Patrick, you know, in particular, you feel like when you listen to him, like I'm barely smart enough to listen to him, never mind talk to him. And you can feel like this company has done something different. What can we learn from Stripe that, you know, the rest of us should pay attention to? Or what have you learned?
For me, the number one takeaway is what Stripe does really well. And I'm going to use a very commercial, a very pop term. They really care about their employees. But how? So going back to the same ethos of if you have a vision of taking care of the companies, really listening to these employees, my job is to quantify it and create that process. As a CFO, I truly believe that we have an already embedded skill set of doing that because we learn debits and credits. We learn accounting. So we can easily take that skill and build these processes. So for me, Stripe is very good at quantifying motivation, quantifying, and then giving employees something back. And I don't mean a monetary value. I mean, give something back as in an ownership, an accountability, a sense of your voice and what you do matter. And how do we do that? And that's why, I mean, if I was to use my own personal example, where I sort of evolved from what Stripe does, but I created something called a P2P a review system,
right,
where I was part of this massive company, completely remote, all parts of the world, employees scattered all around the world. And as we started growing, I could feel that people were not connected to one another. This was the time where Great Resignation and then those things were at the top of the Google searches. You know, I think TikTok had a video of employees attaching their mouse to a fan and the mouse was moving. They were just doing their own thing, but they were not really focused, not really feeling like working. And I could feel that's what's happening. So I removed an entire hierarchical process of appraisals. My idea was, how do I make people and employees feel like they belong and they matter? So this was the vision. That wasn't my vision. But I was in the same room when that was discussed. And that's when we came up with a peer-to-peer review, completely eradicating an appraisal system from top down, but just giving the opportunity for peers to talk about their peers. And that's where we developed that system, which worked really well for us.
I mean, I'll say something which won't shock anyone in Procurement Express probably, which is doing reviews. I don't think anyone really loves it. We'd sit down with a friend and I would go through what they're trying to do and we can talk about that. But somehow when you do it in the context of an organization, I often feel like, well, I am somehow supposed to help this person when I barely know what I'm doing myself.
Yeah.
Sometimes like you can tell the nuts and bolts of what their job is, but the overwhelming responsibility of somehow you almost feel like in a top-down peer review is that you're supposed to fix that person's life. Like it's not just about the job, but it feels like, well, I got to think about their job they're doing and what we're trying to do. And then I got to think about their career and what they might want. And it's just, you know, basically an impossible task. And I feel like you get lipstick on a pig all that way. So I'm really intrigued by this idea because, listen, we're all humans. We're all figuring out as we go.
Yeah.
I like the idea of this peer-to-peer approach as almost like more like a, am I going to say therapy, for a way for people to talk out where they're going themselves. Is that the idea behind this? Or
yeah, it is. Some element of connection is definitely there. So we went back to really thinking what's most important. We studied companies that did really well as a startup and what happens when they become a scale-up or they become a multinational. And what we saw was, what really resonated with me was that me, when I was an employee, I was a young 25-year-old. I just wanted to get my voice heard. I had opinions. I wanted to talk about how to improve efficiency. I wanted to talk about how can we be more sustainable. No one listened to me, right? And then slowly I sort of gave up. And the same thing with, let's say, someone who's not really engaged. How do we get them engaged? The approach has always been, we are Google. We are changing the way that people view the web. Be part of this grand experience of understanding what's on the other side of innovation. Great. That works initially, but what happens then? Because the whole idea of follow me, I'm the leader, is slightly changing. We see that changing as cultural change. So when we looked into it, we saw two things. One, 4 out of 5 employees in an enterprise have ideas that can change the company's trajectory. 4 out of 5 employees, which meant that not only we are not utilizing these ideas of people who are on the field, the developers, the tech teams, the apprentice, the managers, but we're also not giving them the chance to feel connected. So how do you feel connected? By saying or speaking out or giving feedback, because you only give feedback with things that you really care about. So we see together, let's get these ideas and let's get them heard. Let's create a system where people can speak to one another and also provide feedback back to the company. And that's where the peer-to-peer review really came, to be able to cater to those two things.
Okay, so I'm getting vibes of physician heal thyself. You talked about your own malaise in early days of your career, feeling like, well, you're trying to get people interested in sustainability or the bottom line and no one was listening to you. And then what was your own experience of this type of review? Did it actually help you get more engaged with this company? Did you personally feel like more engaged with the mission? And how were you able to quantify whether it worked or not? Because sometimes you get a consultant in, they do something, feels kind of happy clappy and all good. And then you're like, well, I don't know, did that work? I can't tell. So how did you go about figuring out whether this peer-to-peer review had an impact on the bottom line?
That's where the CFO comes in, right? For me, a financial officer at this day and age, a modern version of a CFO, is analytical. It's not just financial. We used a platform at that time, they got acquired, called MoTV. And MoTV, at the end of every Friday, would freeze your screen and ask you, how was your week? And if you didn't answer, the screen would not go away. You had to restart your computer and lose all your work. And we had very bad motivation, and that led to performance EBITDA issues, people complaining more, remote workers not working. As I said, that was quite a trend within the company. We felt it. We knew it. And so the whole idea was, we couldn't obviously replace them. Recruitment cost in itself is too much. Forget training and sort of getting realigned with mission and vision for new employees. So instead of that, we used the P2P measuring system. We created 2 scores. One was an engagement score. That engagement score was based on the feedback that they give us. The more feedback, the better the feedback are. We created a system where we could score them. So let's say Hyatt had an engagement score of 8 out of 10. And then we create an appraisal system where I, as a manager, review my employee and the employee reviews me. And in that way, we figure out another score, which was alignment score. Is the manager aligned with the employees, and is the employee aligned with the manager, i.e. the grander vision, the corporate objective of the company? Just these 2 scores alone showed great improvements to going back to the motivation, that we kept that completely going. And that was the only thing before and after that gave us the indication that this was working like magic.
So you established the baseline, I guess, with this getmotivee.com. I'm looking it up here. So if anyone wants to check that out, I guess you weren't the first person to try and improve the culture. But maybe it sounds like you were the first person to be able to prove it, it had happened. What else had they tried that hadn't worked to try and improve the sense of cohesion?
Just on that note, before I answer your question, it's important to understand that yes, so many people have tried to fix this issue. So many people have the same vision that care more about employees. But I don't think the architectural mindset that a CFO has, I don't think the CFO actually thinks about how can we improve that? And that was the difference for me. I'm not saying I have a unique approach. I know a company called Sideways 6, again, if you want to check them out, who does a feedback system where employees can ask, give feedback back to the employers. And there's other platforms that are showing up. There's a platform where you can click a button and someone gets a digital pat on the back, and they're worth multi-millions in valuation. They're making so much revenue. It just goes to show that human beings just want to be heard and try and feel like they belong. So I think the analytical and the architectural mindset helped me. Going back to what we tried, as I said, we were a remote company. We tried everything. We had football, fantasy football league, which was very, very close at getting people together and understand that there was a bond. We were trying to do this together. We tried a review system where we had not just the manager review the employee, but the employee could review themselves, but not the manager. You know, that was a no-go. You know, that is frowned upon. So we tried all the other ways, and it was a transition. It wasn't straight away go to P2B, but there are methods that needs to be in place. There needs to be a cultural shift in a way. Then there needs to be the right framework in place, and it's different for different companies. I guess that's why I come in, and me as a consultant, it helps me to drop myself in any company, no matter how messed up they are. And trust me, I've seen it all, to be able to create that for them.
Okay, well, you know, you've asked for this question. So what's the most messed up situation you've been dropped into?
I've been dropped into a lot of situations where the co-founders are parting ways. And I know it sounds like, oh, that must happen all the time. But it's when there's so much passion involved in finding a company together with your co-founder and things don't work out, it can be quite brutal. And as me, the CFO, who also has some sort of impact with the culture and how we as a company get more and more efficient and better and create a core competency within the company, I'm always in the middle, always in the middle. So which means that this messy situation has so many times been very personal. Very personal. And to be in that situation, it can be quite difficult. But at the same time, if you can go through it, it actually has always turned out to be for the best.
So I have a business partner, Richard. As far as I know, we're getting along great. You can ask him about it for more detail on that.
Why don't you do a peer-to-peer review every quarter, sit down and tell five things that are amazing about it and the five things about
it. I'm a little bit afraid, but maybe I need to do it anyway. And so you said it gets very personal. You've seen this trend. Looks like, you know, partners going separate ways. What drives business partners? What makes mommy and daddy not want to live together anymore? What's the typical reason why a business partnership hasn't worked out that you've seen?
Ego, ego, ego. There's a book called The Five Dysfunctions of a Team. I cannot recommend this book enough for anyone who's a CEO or who wants to be a C-suite going into a new company. Ego is a killer, not just for relationships, but also for companies. We had a policy, keep your ego outside the door, but someone sneaked it in somehow in meeting rooms. There's always someone who had a bag where there's a bit of ego there, and that can spoil the party very badly.
And is that like just someone wants the recognition again? Like, oh, I'm the guy who started this. I actually, you know, I did most of the work, or I got the key client at the start and nothing would be here. But I guess when it gets ingrained and you have people at the top of the organization, it's harder to control that situation, right? So because who's going to tell them what to do, right? It's easier to roll out something as part of your employee improvement plan or whatever.
That's why it's very, very important to have something that is beyond the two founders, that you guys both believe in. Something that is beyond, which means if someone is doing great, the other person for the business, as long as it's good for the business, you should be okay with it because you're in love with solving this problem. You're in love with the idea that this business can be great. And to be great, it's not about who's right. It's about who's making it great at that time. Yeah. And then that requires a lot of hard work and therapy, I'm sure.
So CFOs are famous for KPIs, but Hyatt, you are famous for one KPI in particular. It might go on your tombstone. Let's see what you do next, but maybe you can tell us a bit about you caused a bit of a storm on LinkedIn recently. What was your KPI that got everyone buzzing and why did it work?
So that was a few years ago, actually, but I worked for a sanitation company that provided waterless toilets to sub-Saharan Africa and Southern Asia. And we worked with governments, so the units were, you know, in the hundreds. And anytime I asked the development team, so how much does it really cost to make a toilet? No one could answer that. As a CFO, my finance team couldn't answer it. And it's like it depends on the use of sustainable plastics that we're using, the compostable, this, that. But I could never figure out how much, which got me so worked up that I remember for a week I worked rigorously in understanding each SKUs, each unit, each cost for even the nut and the screw that goes into it. And then we figured out the cost. That's great. However, what we didn't know is what about the customer lifetime value? How long does the toilet last for? Right. And how long does it cost for the toilet to last to us?
Yeah.
And during that time, how much do we make? So the long story short, we came up with a KPI, which was every time someone flushes the toilet, how much do we make and how much do we lose? And that was the North Star metric for the entire company.
I like it. It's a bit like me and my gym memberships. I pay the membership, but then I divide the number of times I actually go to the gym each year to find out the cost per visit, I guess. Sounds like a similar outlook then. It's fun to talk about, but beyond that, how did that change the outlook? What did people start focusing on then? Was this something you were able to use in your sales message saying, hey, listen, if you buy the other guys, you're going to be paying at $10 a flush. We're at three. How did it go into the organization?
First of all, it has to be so internal first. We have to get everyone to care about. As a CFO, one of the things that we struggle with is how do we get other departments to really care about the numbers? Because everyone just cares about maybe revenue at the top or their personal metrics. So that really got everyone to really think about it. Oh, okay, flush equals to revenue. $1 per flush, we spend 50p per flush. So people started really thinking like that. And even though it might sound like a novelty, it really worked out well. And we used it for marketing purposes, not direct marketing, but when we're sitting down in front of our clients, we definitely use that. And we understand the granularity of the cost, but we also understand the macro vision that we want to bring in with our sustainable solutions. So it really did help us all around.
And I guess, you know, for these waterless toilets, the cost would have been higher than a traditional toilet. So it helped emphasize the value rather than the cost.
100%. It cost us $450. We sold it for $750 for an African family which earned $1 a week. How does that work? We go to the government.
Right.
We go to the government and say, this is something that's going to last you 25 years. So this is how you're going to not only help, but also make money.
So the waterless nature, I guess there's less overhead, there's less plumbing to go wrong, there's a whole range of things. Okay, and that helps to make the case. And if you didn't have that metric, those sales conversations would go totally different. And I guess it also aligns internally, like you said, the team and what you're actually there to do, which I really like. Okay, so listen, let me sort of wrap things up. There's one or two questions I'd like to ask people on the podcast. One is, you know, who's your business hero? But the one that you've picked is if you had one afternoon in a business, any business, what's the first thing you would do to try and make the biggest impact?
I mean, there's so many. This is definitely a curveball question for someone who has a business idea every night before he goes to bed. I think for me it would be somehow to go into industries where we can create a higher margin per product and not focus too much on the lifetime value of the client. So what I mean by that is companies who focus on lifetime value could be fast fashion. Company who want lifetime value could be apps that you're using, because we just want stickiness. We want them to open the app. There's so many, a lot of horrible strategies on how we make people do that too. What I would like to really dwell on and go into a company and just talk about, how can we have high margin impact? A company like, let's say, fast fashion. I actually worked for a company which was the 97th fastest growing company in Europe, a company called Lestrange. They sell one t-shirt, and the whole idea is that one white t-shirt will last you 10 years. Because they have tablets that will renew it. They will. It's almost like an innovative t-shirt.
Right.
And in that way, fast fashion and the impact they have, I think 40 liters per denim jacket that's spent on just making a piece of attire, a piece of clothing. I would create a high margin business and advise companies on how to create that sort of a business model, which hopefully has an impact on not only how we use products, as in the instant gratification that we need at all times to buy new clothes or go to pretty little things or ASOS and keep on buying, that urge will go. Keep on opening that app, even though there's no messages, that will go. But not only that, I think it's also a corporate responsibility on how we can make products with high margin.
I like that idea. David Hanmar Hansen and Jason Fried from Basecamp are recently launched once.com on a similar idea, I guess. You know, you should buy your software, own it forever. You don't have to pay SaaS companies like us every month to use the product. You can just do it once and done. And they've identified this. I'd like the t-shirt example that resonates immediately, because I have in my cupboard right now at least four t-shirts that are on their last legs, and it is a waste and it is stupid. And the immediate benefit of just being able to use that same t-shirt for longer has an environmental legs and makes it's just less annoying to have to go and buy them, etc. And then similarly, I think you're right. A lot of companies are like us, and a lot of companies are, we're all talking about the lifetime value, the wallet share of that customer, because people are being more environmentally sustainable to just go the other way, zig when everyone else is zagging.
Yeah.
Very nice example for someone who's been touted as the rogue CFO here, thinking creatively. I like it. Thanks very much, Hyatt. How can people reach out to you or work with you further, or maybe get some more crazy business ideas for implementing in their own business?
I think the best way is just give me a message on LinkedIn or go get in touch with me via email. My company is called Beyond Elevation. That's my consulting arm. And if you just want to have a chat, just message me. Don't think about any sort of agreements or anything. I just love having a chat with people. So if you have an idea that's really ambitious and you don't know how to make it feasible, whatever it is, I will find a way to make it a feasible step-by-step way to go and achieve it.
Very good. Okay, that's a very good offer to reward those people who have got it to this far in the podcast, I think. Thank you for listening this far into the podcast. Your bonus reward is the ability to be able to sign up for our newsletter, which is at procurementexpress.com/newsletter. You'll get to see Hyatt's smiling face pop into your email along with many other guests. If you're a CFO in particular and you focus on creative thinking, or you have some other ideas on what it takes to be a best-in-class fractional CFO or full-time CFO, I'd love to hear from you. You can get in touch with me, james.kennedy@procurementexpress.com. And Hyatt, you're a star. Thanks very much for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.